Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, good evening, good night, NBN Entrepreneurship and Leadership.
Personally, I'm fascinated by the story.
Trust is an underrated weapon in the business landscape.
I'm a really, really strong believer in learning by doing.
What's the definition of success?
You're trying to come up with an answer to the question. But go ahead, Richard.
You could be right, but you're wrong. Good morning, good evening, good night, Entrepreneurship and Leadership Channel listener on the New Books Network. Today, we've got a very special guest, the author of a book called The Business of Community, David Spinks, and I'm here together with my co-host, Kimon Fontakidis, and business partner and friend. So, David, how would you introduce yourself to someone who had no idea who you were and just bumped into you at a party or a business networking event?
Oh, hopefully they don't start off the conversation with, what do you do? But If they did, I guess I would say I've spent my entire career either building communities for companies, building companies themselves, and have dedicated my career to helping others learn how to build community and working with businesses to teach them how to build community. And so today I'm the VP of community at a company called Bevy that powers events for community teams. And co-founder of CMX, which I started 7 years ago as like the community for community professionals. And yeah, just published The Business of Belonging, which is kind of a collection of my 13 years of doing this work and trying to make the path easier for the next generation of community professionals who are just getting started.
Okay, so everyone's duly warned. Don't ask David, what do you do? Because you gotta, obviously you wouldn't do that at a party, I imagine.
Yeah, in San Francisco, that's all anyone talks about. So maybe I'm tired of it.
Okay, so what's it like working for? Because I don't think Bev is not a huge company, but you've got. Did you have an assistant when you were running CMX? Because we were talking to Peyton Payne, and I was wondering, are you used to having a personal assistant? Is that a new experience being in corporate life, having someone setting up your appointments, or is that a new experience for you?
And so Peyton's not even my assistant. She's just helping out. She works on a bunch of different marketing things for us, and around the book launch, it's been, I'm very grateful. It's been very busy. And so she's helping kind of book all the events and interviews and stuff like that. Bevy's the largest company I've ever worked on. We're over 100 employees now. We just raised our Series B. So we're going to be growing to about 200 this year. Things are growing very quick. But before Bevy, you know, I was a startup founder 3 times, but generally kept teams pretty small. CMX was a bootstrap company for 7 years or for 5 years before the acquisition by Bevy. And so not very used. I've had like virtual assistants before, but the rate of growth and the size of the team and all the things we have going on is new territory for me.
Mm-hmm. So I've read your book, and I have to say, anyone who's interested in community, either for business purposes or indeed for non-business purposes, it's a really excellent book, and we'll come on to it. But I was noticed that in the book, you talk about how when you were a student, they weren't really teaching much to do with the internet, and you somehow persuaded your university or your professors or the course director to introduce some sort of like internet stuff into the course, which was quite an entrepreneurial thing to do. Did you, was that the sort of person you were, like go to your university? Because I know lots of entrepreneurs, but did you go to your university and say, hey, you should, I can teach something in the course that I'm part of?
Yeah. Yeah. I've always been very entrepreneurial and always wanted to build businesses, even since I was a really young kid. And the course came out because I was a business administration major at a school called SUNY Geneseo. It's a state university in New York. If you're not from New York, you've probably never heard of it. If you are from New York, you know it's a really good school, but it's a fine arts college. It's not known for business. I went in originally for political science and then just decided I hated that. So I switched over to business. And when I went to, you know, the marketing classes there, and they were teaching like assembly line management and like the traditional marketing mix. And I was just sitting through these classes, just completely unengaged because I had been very active in the world of online communities since I was a little kid and really passionate about that. I even just completed an internship at a traditional PR firm called Reuter Finn, but I was part of like the web team. So it was like five stories of people in suits writing traditional press releases. And we were this like weird little corner of one floor with like 10 of us that could wear like t-shirts. And we were like pitching web redesigns to like the Metropolitan Museum and just like get more on like the blogging. And like, that was very innovative at the time, just like web design and blogging. And so, and I was starting to look at, you know, Twitter had just come out. I remember my manager called me into his office and was like, can you go find out what this Twitter thing is? And so I went, looked it up. I came back and I said, I have no idea, but it's probably not going anywhere. It seems really silly. I didn't realize completely, like,
that's funny.
But I was really fascinated by those technologies and how they were changing the way business would be done. And then in school, I just wasn't seeing any of that being taught. And so I pitched the idea for like a social media course to the business department, and they actually wouldn't do it. They were just, you know, they were like,
sorry, what year was this? Just to give us context.
2008.
Okay.
And so, you know, they just wouldn't do it. And I ended up, because I had taken a web design course, I ended up pitching the like, web design teacher who was in like computer science department, not even in the business department, on the idea for like building up a social media like reputation and profile and like using it for like career growth and marketing. And he was like, yeah, cool. If you'll put together the curriculum, I'll run a course. And so we were able to launch the first ever social media course here.
That's interesting. Cause this is one of the things we like to explore here is like, because we interview a lot of entrepreneurs and what is it? So like this was in your college years, that's clearly something that's entrepreneurial. You basically took the bull by the horns and decided you wanted something or you saw there was an opportunity for the university. I'd like to go back a little bit that you mentioned that you, when you were younger, like I love to hear like, was there anything like when you were a kid or when you were like, what was the first sort of like, or maybe what's your background? Is it in your family or there? Are your parents people that set up businesses or like, where does it come from basically?
Sort of, yeah. My parents are both immigrants. My mom was born in Israel, from Lazio, and my dad was born in Dublin, Ireland. Grew up in England, met my mom in Israel. They moved to the US and I was born a year later. And they didn't have useful degrees or any degrees and didn't have an established community. And so my parents have always been like hustlers, like working multiple jobs, doing what they have to do to give myself and my sister the lives that they wanted us to have. And I probably get a lot of that hustle and that entrepreneurial spirit from them. My dad sells plush toys to this day. He's like, if you go to a carnival or an arcade in like the tri-state area, there's a good chance that he's one of the guys who's supplying those places with stuffed animals, so the toys that they give away. And my mom, you know, she's a preschool teacher, a Hebrew school teacher, babysits. They'll do whatever it takes to, you know, take care of their family and hustle to make ends meet. And so I got that from them. And that, I think that also gave me a drive to want to frankly, to make money as I got older, because money wasn't something that came easy to us. We weren't wealthy. You know, we were like lower middle class. I always wanted to make sure that my family and later on my parents would have it easier than I did. And so I've always had that kind of dream of being an entrepreneur and being successful in that way. And one of my first kind of experiences, which is both on community and entrepreneurship, was with video games. I became very obsessed with Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4 in middle school. And it worked that I was also struggling mightily to find belonging on a local level. I struggled with finding friendships and connection that way. And I found it through the video game. I became obsessed. I ended up playing it constantly, became one of the top players in the world. Launched a clan with two co-founders of a clan. We became one of the top clans in the game. And then we launched a website and a forum that became one of the most popular communities for Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4. And so I was 14 and I was managing a community with like thousands of members. We were running contests, managing trolls, all the things that community professionals do today. So that was kind of my first like eye-opening experience of connecting with people online and building online community.
But if I could cut in there, David, it's really interesting. Thank you for being so open about that. Obviously, managing this community was like gave you status and you became someone, but it wasn't necessarily making money. What was the first thing you ever did? Or maybe it did make you money. Maybe you got sponsors and stuff. But what was the first thing that actually got you a dollar from anyone ever to pay you to do something entrepreneurial?
That's a good question. I guess like other kids, I was just always doing scrappy jobs. I worked a lot in the restaurant world as a busboy, and like that teaches you a lot about working with people. I was always a kid that would like go offer to like shovel snow around the neighborhood and charge like $20.
So ringing on doorbells and that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah.
There's like an old lady that I used to go do like just like computer stuff for her. She'd be like, just like, I need to organize these documents and their power, like, organize numbers and spreadsheets for her. But yeah, things like that.
Cool. And then, that is interesting that you had that background in community and then you carried that forward. I mean, so like you went to college, like, so how did that stick with you? I mean, you went to college. I mean, I actually studied poli-sci as well, and you know, whatever. I guess it's good for a conversation, but other than that, it's not really useful for anything. So how did the community, like, just talk us through how you got to, you know, or was it just something that stayed with you? Did you leave it aside and start something else, or?
Yeah, it's a good question. So after, you know, launching that forum, I just continued to stay very active in online communities, IRC communities, gaming communities. When anything launched online, I was very quick to be an early adopter on anything like Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, back in the day, like LiveJournal, DeadJournal, Ning. Was just like always active in these online spaces. And I think that internship was probably one of the first times that I connected the dots of like, oh, like you can do this for businesses and this could actually be a job, which was absurd at the time. The idea that you build online community as a job is not something anyone had ever told me in my entire life. You would not see that anywhere. Like it wasn't a thing. And, but there was starting to be talk of like social media marketing a lot at that time, which was different than building community social media marketing. But there was a lot of kind of energy around building a Twitter following or Facebook page or whatever for a business. And I became very plugged into that kind of space. And I was still in college and I started a blog. It was just my name, davidspinks.com. And I was writing about what I was seeing in the world of social media business, which was still, I think I was by far like the youngest person writing about it at the time. I guess I was kind of fearless at that time too, and would like put a lot of bold claims or like challenge really important people publicly online on Twitter, like challenge what their were. And I made a pretty good name for myself. I was in a frat, sitting in my dorm room in the frat house, there would be like a party going on downstairs, and I'm writing about like concepts of social identity and how our identity is changing in the internet era. So it was an interesting like juxtaposition in that scene. And then a company read one of my blog posts and then emailed me while I was a senior in college. And they said, hey, we're going to be going through this accelerator program in Philly for the summer. It's just two of us who are developers. We need someone to build our community. Do you want to come join us as a community manager for the summer? And I was like, will you pay me? And they're like, oh. I was like, will you pay for my rent? And they're like, yeah, sure. I was like, okay, fine. So I found it.
How much did they pay you?
$5,000 for the summer, which actually isn't bad, like for an internship.
Absolutely.
Nonstop. And so I joined that company as a community manager, and that was my first job as a community manager, building community for a company. And that team ended up building, we ended up pivoting our idea. We ended up building Seatgeek, ended up being one of the largest online ticketing sites in the world that, you know, rivals StubHub. So I kind of lucked into a really great opportunity with that. But that was my first time getting paid for it, and I was like, oh shit, like maybe this can be a job.
So did you keep working there, or did you move on? Because I and also what's really interesting, I think, about this opportunity was not only that you got to monetize or whatever, have to use your community skills, but you also probably, was it your first sort of experience with the startup world, and like, this is what startup world looks like, and this is what, you know, how it works if you wanted to set it, was that be accurate? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I was like going to like networking events and stuff like that in New York, starting to get connected in the startup world that way. But you know, when you haven't worked on anything and you're that young, there's really offer people. So it's just mostly me going to events and just trying to just, you know, have a good conversation with people. Yeah. So the quick of it is, we were in that accelerator for 3 months. Halfway through it, we pivoted from a company called Scribnia. We sold that product and pivoted to SeatGeek. But the person we sold Scribnia to, this man named Marc Duquette, an entrepreneur out of Montreal, who was buying up all different content sites to basically create like an ad network. And he needed someone to run Scribnia. So he wasn't trying to run that business. He just wanted it to continue to grow. It was like a blogger review site. So it was like Yelp for bloggers. And so the co-founders that hired me, they were like, oh, well, David has done everything except for building this site. So you should just hire him as your general manager. And so that's what I did. And then 3 months out of college, I became the general manager and was just running this business end to end, basically, and built out a team.
Okay, wow.
And got kind of thrown into the fire that way.
And were you hiring? Did you have many people report? What was the maximum number of people you had reporting to you? How big was your team?
That team, probably about 3 or 4, mostly remote, you know, developers. We worked with like a development outsource company. And so still very small.
But still, you did have to manage people though. So, and how did you find that?
Extremely hard.
Yeah, you were so young too. You were so young. I mean,
yeah, I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, we ended up pivoting the company because what I believed was it was like Yelp for bloggers, which was consumer facing. And what I was noticing is what we now consider like a very standard thing in like influencer marketing. I was starting to see that become something that was interesting in the world of bloggers, because a lot of companies were starting to want to, you know, partner with bloggers, do blogger outreach, have them write about their products. And so I said, why don't we have all this incredible data about bloggers? Why don't we pivot this into a B2B program where now we can help businesses find bloggers that are relevant to them? And we turn it into a company called BlogDash. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm very good at like coming up with new ideas and getting them off the ground and getting people excited about them. To this day, I'm still learning how to be a better like operator and manager and scale things up. But help get that off the ground, ended up running that for about a year and a half. And then because I was doing that and managing a team and running a company, other companies started to perceive me as, frankly, just knowing more than I actually knew.
which is great
in some ways. Up for high expectations. And so a company called Zarly, was blowing up. They came out of Startup Weekend, where you pitch an idea over a weekend and you create a ragtag team right there on the spot and start building it. It was like the most successful company to come out of there. Raised $15 million from Ashton Kutcher, Groupon, Sands Capital, Kleiner Perkins, like the who's who of investors at the time. And we were like a reverse Craigslist. So it was like you can put what you want and people can respond with offers. And they came to me and said, like, we'd love for you to be our director of community. And so I ended up leaving Blogdash, joining Zarly. And all of a sudden there, I was running a 4-person team. We launched in 15 different cities, building communities and platforms and programs. And I, you know, I was young and ambitious. I was like, you know, fuck it. I can figure this out. I'll go ahead and do it. And it failed pretty mightily, both in terms of the company itself didn't quite work. But also, like, I was just in a deep end, ended up burning out. I ended up getting fired from that job, which was like the lowest point in my entire career, and took a long time to get myself back up on my feet after that. But that was the next step.
I have a question. I think we're coming to a pivotal moment in the story, but up until this point, in any of these spots, were you given equity or sort of like a chance to be, or were you just a hired hand every time?
Yeah. Yeah, I was given equity in some ways. So if the question is how much money have I made, the answer is
No. I was just curious if you've been exposed. like how you got to the point where you actually would then go off and do it on your own. Were they throwing you like deals? Like, were you getting option? How did it work up until that point?
Yeah, a lot of people don't talk about it, and I'm very open about it, but now a lot of people ask about it. And yeah. First I messed up with SeatGeek. They had messed up first because it was their first startup, which is
right. You
know, smart, successful entrepreneurs I know, Jack Ritzinger and Russell D'Souza, insanely successful and smart people. But it was their first startup. They gave me 1% to be the intern with no vesting, no cliff, just I got 1%. And when we pivoted from Scribnia to SeatGeek, they basically said, like, hey, we'd love to like kind of bring back all the equity because we're like starting a new company. So we'd love to, you know, buy the equity from you. And they offered me $5,000 for it. And I said, you know what? I think I'm going to hold on to it. I was right out of college. I didn't have a dollar to my name. I was like in debt. But I was like, nah, 5,000, you know, I'll hold on to it. And they're like, oh, well, we really appreciate you believing in us. What about 6,000? I was like, done.
Yes. Nice move.
Would be worth millions of dollars today. Which, you know, who knows how that would have completely changed everything I would have done after that. If I like, wealthy. And then Zarly, I ended up getting fired 10 months into the gig. So I didn't meet my 1-year cliff and didn't end up getting any equity out of that.
Okay.
I started a company called Feast, owned a lot of that. That didn't work out. We sold the product for basically just to break even and get the investors back some money and didn't make any money on that. Started CMX, bootstrapped that, pretty much went into debt. you know, made enough to like continue to sustain myself and you know, live a scrappy life. And you know, now it was acquired by Bevy, and it's another lottery ticket, but I do own equity.
Yeah, but the lessons to learn. I mean, look, a lot of this is, you know, we get, I don't know, like between 1,000 and 2,000 listeners for each episode. And, you know, a lot of these people, I think, are like, they want to get inspired and they want to, and they want to, they're going along their road as well. And so like, this is valuable just to hear, like going for the equity, negotiating the equity. Like, I love the $5,000 to $6,000 story. I mean, that is a very valuable lesson. And so today, so basically you've taken this road today and now, you're in Bevy. But can we talk a little bit about community? Because I'm really interested in that. I come from more sort of a B2B sort of whatever entrepreneur, but sort of B2B sales. And like, I wonder, I just, you know, I naturally wonder when I listen to you, is there a role, like, is there a role for community in everything? Is there, you know, is community only limited to, like, when I think about Apple and, like, the Apple community, and when I think about, you know, there's plenty of little, like, product, I guess, communities. People are evangelists and they love their product,
right?
And they have a community around it. But is there, can you talk a little bit about, like, who's community, is community something that a lot of companies can use, or is it limited to the types of companies that can have a community?
All businesses can build community because all businesses are made up of people. And when there's people, there's identity, and people have an identity that maybe they don't get to express somewhere in the way they want to today. And that's an opportunity to give them a space to do that. And so, yeah, I mean, if it's a product like Apple, or, you know, Sephora has a thriving community, Fitbit has a thriving community, products that people love and use a lot, and it's like an active part of their life, very easy to build kind of fan base community for them. That you can build for your employees. You can build a community for your larger industry, right? So, like, Branch Metrics is a mobile analytics platform. You know, not necessarily the sexiest identity like Apple, but they built a mobile growth community for the larger identity that they're trying to work around, where anyone who's focused on, like, how do you grow using mobile analytics and mobile ads, growing mobile apps, they built a community for them where they can teach them, they can teach each other and connect with other people who are doing that work. Culture Amp launched their People Geeks community for anyone who's in, like, a people or HR role. You have Salesforce with their Trailblazer community. So B2B, B2C.
Okay. Even, for B2B, you can set up, you're saying basically set it up around the problem that you're trying to, I think you're saying set it up around the problem that you're trying to solve.
There are many layers of identity in every community.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also employees is also obvious. Employees is also a very good one.
Be the larger category. So, like, not just customers, but anyone who's in the industry that you're working on, right? Like HubSpot, inbound with inbound marketers as well. Or it can be a customer identity. It could be an ambassador identity, right? Like the Skimbassador program. The Skim's the largest newsletter in the world, and they run the Skimbassador program where they reward people for referring subscribers. It could be a power user identity, like the Yelp Elite for Yelp's most active reviewers, or Airbnb's most active hosts with a super host program. So, or it could be employees, internal communities, especially as companies are all going remote, are becoming a huge thing now. So anywhere where there's people, there's an opportunity to connect people to each other and help make them more successful by empowering them to organize each other and educate.
Yeah, and if you read the book, you know, which I strongly recommend, you give really powerful example, like the difference between Rosetta Stone and Duolingo, how, you know, companies with strong communities basically became far bigger businesses in terms of their market cap and value, and you give plenty of examples. But you also pointed out that, you know, the less sexy the industry, the less cool it is, the more opportunity there is to build community because people feel marginalized. Can you talk a bit about that? Why is community more important? Maybe more of an opportunity for the people who aren't the cool kids.
Well, because you can create a space where they feel cool, right? Like when we were all kids, for the most part, you know, it's pretty clear what cool is, right? It's the kids that are athletic and wealthy and dress nice and are popular. As we get older, you start to find all these new opportunities to be cool, right? You could be cool and be a gamer or play Magic the Gathering. In that group, you're cool, right? It opens up to these different networks. And so if you have a customer base who traditionally does not feel cool in their identity, and you create a space where they are celebrated and respected and understood and seen, that where they feel cool in the space that you create, you'll have a massive center of gravity that's drawing those people toward you, right? So, you know, an example I give in the book is the Ministry of Testing, software tester, not the most, you know, sexy role title. All the communities that had existed back in the day were what you would expect for software testers, kind of very dry, very, like, you know, straightforward Q&A, not a lot of personality or fun. And it was Rosie Sherry who launched a Ministry of Testing. And, like, you go to that website and there's, like, all these monsters all around it. They're kind of the mascots, and it's just got a much more playful vibe. And it brought the contrast that people in that space were looking for, because just because they work in a space that other people perceive as boring to them, the work is exciting and they're very curious, passionate about it. And it was exciting for them to have a place that looked at this as something that's fun and playful, right? And it's the experience we had with CMX as well, because when we launched CMX, the community manager didn't feel cool. The community manager felt, you know, companies are still perceiving community managers as low level. They'd often just hire an intern to manage a community. No one really understood what they did. They'd go to a marketing conference and have to explain what community management was 1,000 times.
Right.
We manage a Facebook page, right? No, let me explain it. And then they come to CMX Summit for the first time and look around and see hundreds of other people who...
with exactly the same problems.
Problem with them. And we'd be on stage, I'd be on stage saying, like, community is the future of business. This is where things are going to go. And you're doing some of the most important work in the world. And it's extremely hard work. It's work that takes a professional and a lot of experience. And we're so excited that you're all here so we can like learn together and grow this industry. That made them feel... You know, I still get messages today where they said that was the first time I felt like this was a career path for me that I can stick with. And why? I ended up
this is really cool. And I want to bring it to sort of a practical level, because like, so the main business I'm involved in is in a translation. It's a translation company. And the people we sell to are people we call like localization managers. It's the people in the company that it's responsible for translation. And they're often massively underappreciated within their organization and massively underappreciated, you know, only by us, the people that sell to them, basically, the only people that sort of recognize them. And so if we were trying to set up a community, and this is, I'm trying to get sort of like a practical, if anybody's listening to this and they're also thinking, hey, I know a group of people that this sounds like, how do you actually set up a community? And like, what are the aspects of it? Like, what do you focus on to make it successful?
Yeah. So the first step is always going to be to talk to those people. Like you're building a product, you don't want to just start building it. You need to really understand who you're building it for and what their pain points are. So if you got on the phone today with 10 of those translators and just had a conversation with them, what are your pain points? Where do you go today to get support? How many other translators do you know out there? What do you think a community could do to serve you, and understand their language, understand what's exciting to them, understand where they're going right now to find that emotional support and the practical support. That will give you a lot to work with. And then you know, there's some simple things you can do, like giving them a name, right? Like in the Ministry of Testing, it's just like a fun name. Giving people weeks is like a fun name. It's a name for the member that they can identify with. So I don't know what you call them, translation heroes or something.
Yeah, that's a very good one, actually.
There you go, run with it.
Yeah. Well, no, and then like, but like, how would it be like, you know, I'm sure people are doing this, like they have like, they've created LinkedIn groups and stuff like that. You know, that would be like a typical way that they would do it, but I'm not sure that that's really meeting the bill here. What you're talking about.
Well, so there's the design of the community identity. And I talk a lot about the social identity in the book. We talk about the social identity cycle. And so the social identity cycle is three stages: identification, participation, and validation. All right. So first is identification. So that is the first step. Talk to the people, really hone in on what is the social identity you're creating, whether it's a name, the symbols that exist in this space already, the language that they use, the logo you create, just really try to hone in on who this person is that you're trying to organize. And then you get into participation. That's where you start to think about, okay, what platforms are they currently using that we can engage them on? Or do we want to bring them onto our own platform? What does that membership journey look like? So how are they participating? How are we onboarding them? How are we engaging them? And then what kind of leadership positions can we set up for them once they're really, really engaged? And then you have validation, which is, so say this person's like, I'm a translator. I identify with this group because I just heard about it. I'm going to participate for the first time. I'm going to post in the LinkedIn group or the Slack group or wherever you end up posting. and I'm going to introduce myself. I'm going to start, you know, interacting a little bit. And then validation says, well, they need to feel a sense of reward and validation for that participation. So if they introduce themselves, did they get a nice response to that introduction, or did it just kind of go unreceived into the abyss and now they don't feel validated? They read.
That's valuable.
They learn something. Did they get something out of it? Did someone from the team speak in a message? They're like, hey, so glad you're here. Let me know if you have any questions. And so they feel very welcome in there. If they feel validated, it reinforces the identity, and that's why it's a cycle. So now they might start to feel like, oh, maybe I am, you know, someone who can be a member of Translation Heroes. And so now I'm ready to participate more. Maybe next time I ask a question, maybe eventually I attend an event. Maybe I even eventually host events and become a leader in the community, become a moderator. And as they participate more and more, they feel greater and greater validation, and the identity continues.
Yeah, I mean, I actually run a number of different community groups, and some of them are completely for fun. Like I run a fan club for a podcast called the Beef and Dairy Network Podcast, which is a comedy podcast, and it's an unofficial community on Facebook. And we have a ritual when a new member joins, we moo them in, and we post GIFs of guys, and it's very funny. And it's a very, very niche thing, but also serious things like an alumni group for Cambridge University entrepreneurs around the world. And as a result of reading your book, we've just moved on to a mid-price platform called Mighty Networks, which is not because there's no money in it. I fund it myself. You know, I don't want something too expensive, but I literally went in and welcomed all the latest round of members, which you said is a really important thing. And you say and I also wrote to the city leaders, because there's one in New York and Dubai, saying when people from your town join, I want you to welcome them. And you know, that was your direct sort of, you know, I knew it for the fun stuff, but you know, is very practical. And I wanted to ask you about resources, because you get communities where, you know, like the Salesforce community, where there's tons of money, there's no issue it's worth spending thousands of dollars onboarding someone who's buying Salesforce from Salesforce because there's money in it. But are there any tips and tricks for managing communities where basically there's either zero money involved or it's so small that, you know, you can't really put all those resources in? Because you talk a lot about the sustainability of communities and how if they're not paying their way, sooner or later they collapse, which is a very thought-provoking point.
Well, I just want to say I love that example. I wonder if you ever accidentally moo in the alumni community. And you're like, oh, sorry.
Funny you should say that. I actually was joking with another community manager, and someone new joined the other community. This is Village in the City, which is a non-profit. I said, be careful we don't move him in, because exactly that. So, you know, interesting you spotted that already.
That weird stuff is what makes communities special. It's like the things that make you weird are what make the community really valuable. So embrace your weirdness, find the weird things, make it a ritual, and that's what sets it apart. A huge premise of this book, even in the name, The Business of Belonging, the reason I chose that title is because the tension of thinking about business and belonging in the same sentence makes some people uncomfortable. But having worked in this space for 13 years, both with everything from the largest companies in the world to brand new startups, just, you know, I've done a ton of workshops and work with Facebook admins, who are generally people who are just like doing it because they're passionate about organizing a community for girls who love traveling or gay dads. And there's like no business part of it. They're just like, I want to help people. I started this community. All of a sudden there's millions of members in it, and I'm managing this like large group of volunteers. And across the board, whether it's a huge company or just someone doing it casually, there's a struggle for the community builder to figure out, how do I make this financially sustainable? And for the big business, that means, how do you do it at the scale of a Salesforce or a Nike, or, you know, a company with thousands of members? And you need a ton of resources to do it properly and do it well. To that Facebook group admin who's putting a ton of hours into building this community and managing it and keeping it healthy and managing volunteer teams and seeing no financial return for it, so they can't take care of themselves or be able to pay others to like help with moderation or hire a team to work on this stuff. And so to me, it's critical that we stop looking at business and belonging as these opposite things, and we start looking at it as a balance of how do we build communities that are both meaningful to our members, but also financially sustainable, so that we can continue to invest in it and give the people working on it, the organizers, the resources they need to do this over time, because otherwise they're just going to burn out or the community is just going to fail.
I noticed there's one mistake. I've been a TEDx organizer involved in the world of TED and TEDx for 11 years, and I recently stopped, but you actually incorrectly say that TEDxers are allowed to make money out of it, that you say you get it for free and they can make a business out of it, which absolutely isn't true. And it's interesting, the motivation for the TEDx organizers are multiple, and sometimes they have connected businesses, like their public speaking coaches or something like that, which is kind of, they can build their personal brand and monetize elsewhere. But there are examples of communities which run on volunteer ether, and TEDx is an example. In fact, you actually have to pay, because if you want to do a bigger event, you have to go to a TED event, which costs a serious amount of money, $6,000 or $10,000 for a ticket. So there are examples of that, but maybe religion is like that. People are a member of a church, and basically they give money to the church, but the church never pays them back. So do you just feel that there's a group of, or maybe they don't pay back in terms of, you know, going to heaven or whatever?
They do get big payback in other ways, but anyway,
eternal life, you know, that's sorry, you know, for example. But do you just feel that those are communities that you're not going to study, or do you feel that ultimately, you know, religion isn't sustainable and sooner or later religion is going to collapse because it doesn't pay its way?
No, I mean, religion, they're making plenty of money. So this is an example of like, they've figured out a way to monetize community. Now, like, are they doing it ethically? Are they doing it in a way that's fair to the members? Like that's a larger conversation. But the fact that they're saying like, we are giving you value and that value is worth something, and so we are going to ask you to pay for that value. Which I don't think is a bad thing, because
no, I think it's actually the best example. Actually, I think I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that's a perfect example that everybody can understand. I mean, is it, you know, they're monetizing something of value.
Exactly. They absolutely are. I mean, yeah, we can dive into religion and, you know, the extent to which they leverage the belief system and things like that to drive people. Are they having people give more than they're able to? You know, where is that money coming from? And stuff.
Yeah, those are ethical questions. And I don't want to, maybe this isn't the podcast.
but exactly. The point is, like, from a perspective of like, anyone who's building community is creating value for people. And so what there's different ways to monetize a community, and probably not enough community builders straight up just charge for membership. And that's in part because the internet has made community so free and open. But I think my thinking is that that's going to change in the same way that content and creators are changing now, in that the internet has made content extremely free and ubiquitous. So, you know, bloggers and podcasters and creators, video creators, they struggle to make ends meet for a while. And now we're getting a point through things like Patreon, and now Twitter's launching Superfollow. All these platforms are trying to figure out how to help creators be successful, because they're realizing that that's what needs to happen for creators to continue to be on their platform and invest there. I think we'll start to see a similar thing in communities, where it's like, yeah, there's a lot of free stuff out there, but we're going to create this really valuable experience and be able to charge for it in a sustainable way.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting. And I mean, in a sense, you've alluded to this already, that, you know, you got huge value out of community from a sort of psychic point of view when you were a teenager. It was the first time you felt at home somewhere, even if you weren't getting money out of it. And so you obviously appreciate the value of community doesn't have to be monetary, but on the other hand, if it's not self-sustaining, it sooner or later will collapse. So, and I think you made the point very clearly now and in the book. But in terms of your personal goals, you were financially motivated. I think in your interview with Andrew Warner on the Mixergy podcast, you alluded to the fact you don't feel you've really made it yet. So are you still and I say that respectfully, because at one level you're a big name in the world of community management, but you haven't made it maybe financially to the goals that you want to. But what's success going to mean? And suppose Bevy goes public and you get a seven-figure sum or an eight-figure sum in your bank account, are you going to carry on doing what you're doing, or do you have like other things you want to do after this? And because right now obviously you're kind of all in on Bevy, and that's a perfectly rational thing to do, but what's success going to be like for you?
Yeah, well, I just a note on that too. Like, I've been spending a lot of time recently on the topic of just what's enough. And I was reflecting back to 10 years ago when I would think about this question. I'd say I just want to have enough that I can take care of my family, live in a nice house, be able to take vacations whenever we want, have a sense of autonomy over my career and my life. And so I was like thinking back to that, and I was like, well, I have all that now. More would be nice, but I'm doing great. I have all those things that I always said I wanted. And it's you're always pulled into this idea of I need more, I need more, I need more, especially in the world of startups and entrepreneurship. And a person like me that just always and nothing ever feels like enough, because you always see that next level that you want to hit. But I've been reflecting a lot on that question lately, and finding new balance with the idea that in many ways I feel like I've made it. And so I don't have to worry about how do I just get more money? I can really pick and choose the things that I really want to spend my time on. I feel really passionate about. What will I continue to do? Whatever comes next? I don't know. I can't tell you, but I think I'm still deeply curious about community, and I'm still deeply curious about this industry, and I'm really enjoying the process of trying to solve the puzzle of making community a core part of every business, that the value is understood and assumed in the same way we think about marketing today. Every business is marketing. I truly believe every business is going to have community, and I'm enjoying being part of the process of figuring out how do we get there. So as long as I'm still curious about it, I'm going to continue to work on it.
And how do you feel about you've spent your whole career in startups, right? In one startup after another. And are you sort of passionate about is your next? The next step, it's going to be another, either you'll found it or join, or will it be a startup? Is that how you think about, or do you think about some just change, doing, trying to do some? I'm just curious, how do you feel about startups and the startup world in general? Because you've been in it your whole career, and is that something that then, Richard actually is very involved in startups. I'm not at all involved in startups. I'm more of the traditional business guy. So I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, I love startups. I love working with startups. Love working with founders. I can't help it. I will probably start another thing in the future. What that looks like, if it's a quote unquote startup or another bootstrapped kind of sustainable business that doesn't have to reach $1 billion to be successful, or I don't know. I'd say whatever I do next is going to come after a pretty healthy dose of rest and doing nothing.
Okay. Well, thank you.
On that path, I've been on this path for 13 years, and another huge life-changing thing is we just had a baby. I have a 7-month-old at home, and so
congratulations.
So that's definitely giving me this moment of, I want to make sure that as I go into this next phase of my time, thoughtfully and intentionally, not just working of more. I think that's only gonna come after taking a breath and kind of my head up and seeing where things are at and where I want to go from there.
Great. Well, I appreciate we're coming to the end of our allotted time, and I'll send you and share in the show notes a wonderful talk from TEDx I organized, which is the most popular talk we ever had at our TEDx about the way Dutch people raise kids. It was an American and a British lady who both married Dutch guys, and they wrote a book called The Happiest Kids in the World, and just talking up Holland, the Netherlands, against America and the UK as being, and it's really, really compelling. If you've got a young child, it's not, I read it after all my kids were, it was too late for me to
do it. You made all the mistakes.
I made all the mistakes, but a couple of questions about your attitudes. Do you see yourself as a competitive person, and do you think you've been lucky, or talked about the startup world where you're always wanting more. Have you sort of dealt with that in terms of thinking about what's enough, or are you still like a highly competitive person who basically needs to beat those guys who are mean to you at school and all the rest of it?
Yeah, probably that. I'm a very, very, which is like weird for me because I'm also a people pleaser. So sometimes, you know, I always like make friends with my competition, but I'm still like, I'm going to beat you, but like, let's be friends. So it's like weird tension in me, but very competitive. I also grew up playing like every sport. I still play a lot of sports. It's just kind of part of my nature. Did I get lucky? Yeah, absolutely. I believe my theory on luck is basically just like you have to keep putting yourself in a position to get lucky. So hard work alone isn't going to get you where you need to go, but without hard work and putting yourself out there and taking risks, you're not putting yourself in a position for something spontaneous to happen. And my career has been a series of fortunate events, but those fortunate events always came because I wrote a blog post that I was afraid to put out there, or I took a leap and put myself in a position that I was afraid of, that just somehow got me to the next landing pad. So put yourself in a position to get lucky.
Well, you mentioned you're going to take a long break after the next chapter of your business life, and you've got long hours in your day job, and you're raising your family and all those challenges. So in a moment, I'm just going to ask Kimon to wrap up, and the few thank yous he should do. I'm going to say that do read the book, and I don't always say that. I'm a community manager, and I think your book is excellent, so I'm going to strongly encourage that. But Kimon, do you want to just do a few thank yous?
I'll do that. I just also want to reflect on like one of the things you mentioned was the question of enough. And I think that's a really sort of important thing for people to sort of come to terms with, because if you don't, then like, and again, once again, if you're listening to this and you're younger or earlier on, you know, basically David was saying he came up with a number, an amount or whatever, a thing, and then he's faced it, and then he's like facing it again now. Well, he's got that now. And that's really what happens. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, Richard and I have talked about what it takes to be on the billionaires list. And like,
I'm not quite there yet, you know?
No. Yeah.
But not yet.
What motivates those people? And it's like, and it's all this, it's really, we suspect it's a lot of stupid stuff. Like, am I on the third or the, like, I think they get pissed if they drop like three slots. And like, you're talking about really stupid motivation for life. Anyway, I thought that was a very nice little thing that you talked about there that a lot of people should think about. But yeah, as Richard said, you know, thanks to everybody who took the time to listen to David and us for an hour. You know, I thought it was really interesting. I really enjoyed this. Thanks to my daughter, Magda Fontakidis, who does the, this is what this podcast is all about, David. It's about promoting my daughter and her work. So this is all just a front for that. So she does the graphic design and video editing. We have a very talented high school intern named Magda Wiskosz, who does PR and promotion for us. The MBN team, the platform where this podcast goes out, they do all the technical sound editing and all that stuff that allows this to go on. So if you enjoyed this, please subscribe at MBN, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you liked it, like it, comment it, share it, and let everybody know.
And David, thank you so much for taking the time. I thought this was really interesting. I learned a lot about community that you're, as you saw, I was thinking about how can I already implement this into my business. And I hope other listeners have the same.
I'd love to hear.
Thank you very much indeed. Bye-bye.